Thank you, Jerry.
My name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
A lot of other things, too. My sobriety date is August 5th, 1985. My home group is Living in the Solution, Saturday morning men's meeting. My sponsor, his name is Stan S. He's got a sponsor, got a home group. Today I'm living very happily in steps 10, 11, and 12. We share our experience, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and really what we were like, what happened to us, and what our life is like now as a result of what happened to us. So I'll try and keep the stories of trauma out of it and just kind of go through what it was that made me pick up alcohol for that first time. Just because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, I qualify as a strange type of alcoholic. I had a monkey on my back that liked to eat grapes on a regular basis, so I have plenty of experience with powders in every form. Out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, it's just alcohol. Being the experience that I have in the time in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're either a dog or a poodle. I'm just a dog, so I don't need to differentiate myself. I was born in Madison, Wisconsin. Both of my parents were at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My father was the head of the student court. My mother was a part-time student and full-time member of counterculture. Madison was the hotbed in the Midwest of anti-Vietnam beliefs in the 60s, and my mother was very active and actually kind of famous for her participation. They met when the SDS was kicked off campuses across the country and stayed together, and then came I. So I was born to interesting parents. We immediately moved to Southern California, lived there for a few years, and then my father decided to leave California and we headed to New York. I grew up in a small town in Westchester County, called Armonk, or North Castle, which was north of the city by about an hour. My father continued to be an attorney, and my earliest recollections of growing up were him working and writing on weekends, and he and my mother trying to figure out how to be a couple in the other time. I have a younger brother, and from my earliest recollections, I was never comfortable inside my skin. I thought my parents were weird. It made me uncomfortable. I didn't like the way that I felt when I looked at them. I didn't like the way that I interacted with them. I didn't like the way that they talked to me. I didn't, you know, as I got older, I didn't like having a little brother. He got all the attention. And there was just something that stirred in the center of my being. It wasn't that I could really identify what it was. I was just uncomfortable. As I got older, that discomfort continued to increase. At a young age, I picked up wine from a Friday night dinner and had my first drink. And I remember not particularly caring for it, but I liked the way that it felt warm as it went down. I was probably about 8 years old. Yeah, 7, 8 years old, something like that. It got me lightheaded, and that I really didn't care about, but I just kind of felt okay after having that first drink. And I lived in my head and was experiencing what I look back at as crises from a young age. I couldn't turn my head off. I was always struggling with the way that I thought about everything else, and I didn't like that. I also was born with bilateral club feet, so I knew I was physically different than everybody else at a young age. They had to correct them and set them in casts, and then I had to wear these horrible orthopedic shoes with braces that came out of them from a young age. So I am the original Forrest Gump. I hated myself. I mean, I had, you know, at 8 years old, absolute self-loathing, absolute fear of what others thought of me, that they could see that I was different. I know I had very, you know, we grew up, everybody was blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and I had very ethnic features. I had very full lips, a large pronounced nose that was too big for my face, very curly hair. We used to refer to it as Jufro. It was just, you know, the way that I understood growing up, and it was not who I wanted to be or how I wanted to be. I wanted to be a Todd or a Bill or a Kevin. I wanted to be blonde, and I wanted to be able to play sports like everybody else. I couldn't, and it was frustrating. And that angst, that self-loathing, that absolute disappointment before anything was accomplished in my life was eating away at me. And what I found at an early age was that alcohol soothed the edges to that hole that sat in the center of my being. And that's really where, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I know that as I started to take a drink more often at a young age, an alcoholic was born. Because what it did was it took me away from being what I was in my skin. You know, I could feel safe. I could feel comfortable. I could feel like I could communicate, because that was the only way that I knew that I would be okay to communicate. Other than that, I was terrified. I didn't make a lot of friends. I didn't talk to girls. You know, I didn't know how to communicate with my own parents. I didn't know how to let anybody know that I wasn't okay. And little by slowly, I got more and more involved with alcohol. And we know the story, you know, man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, and the drink takes the man. Well, I got into drinking regularly. And I found the crowd that I could drink with. The reason that I became a part of that crowd was I could steal the alcohol from my grandfather's liquor cabinet, and I set myself up to be used. None of those people I drank with at an early age were friends. They absolutely used me for what I could do for them, and I was so desperate to fit in. I was so desperate for your recognition and for your friendship, because I was isolated in my own skin, and that's, you know, that's where it all started. I wish I could tell you that I had a really, really happy childhood. I had everything given to me. I grew up never hungry. My parents never... Well, my mom beat me. My mom beat me regularly out of frustration with my father. I was just growing up. You know, I was having a smart mouth. I was being intelligent and having a witty comeback that was really just disrespectful. She was my mother, and she let me know that she was the boss. But then resentment came in, and I started to drink over those resentments too. You know, by the time I'm 13 years old, I'm using powdered alcohol, and I'm using, you know, my grandmother, rest her soul, struggled with her weight, and I would steal her diet pills, and I would mix them with whatever it was we were drinking, because that's how I had a more effective way of numbing, not the hole, but the edges to that hole. And you'll hear me talk about the edges to that hole, because that's what grew over the years as I continued to drink. You know, I graduated high school, full-blown alcoholic and addict. I was lost. Everything always rhymed with wrong. I always felt last, lost, and least. And I was desperate to show anyone what a good friend I could be and why you would want me as a friend. But I never belonged. And I felt the rejection, and I got resentful, and I would get angry. And I would drink, and I would isolate. So I went from a public school to a private school in Tarrytown, New York. Since we have another New Yorker here, I had to acknowledge. And I got asked to withdraw because of my behavior at that school. Finished out at a local college, at an art school in Purchase, SUNY. Pulled my first geographic to Chicago, where I wound up just absolutely hurting everyone and anything that came in my path. I hurt family members. I hurt friends of family members. I hurt friends of family members. I mean, I just was an absolute whirling dervish through everyone's life. And I would lie, cheat, and steal so that I could drink, so that I could afford a lifestyle that would allow me to drink without having to do anything else. See, I didn't want to have a normal job like other people. I was entitled. And I didn't want to actually put in the effort to do anything that would hold me accountable, because I was spoiled. And I had no life skills, and I had no coping mechanisms other than the fact that I knew that if I picked up a drink, it would soothe the edges to that hole that sat in the center of my being, and that I could buy time and figure something out. That's really all I did. And by the ripe old age of 19, right before my 20th birthday, I had been homeless in Chicago. I had been in Chicago Lakeshore Hospital. I had dodged death quite a few times, not just by my own drinking and the people that I chose to hang out with, but it was really just an act of mercy from God that I wasn't killed. You know, Chicago was an interesting experience for me. My dad's family is from there, and my dad's family is an old Jewish family from Chicago. So I got away with murder, literally. I didn't care, because I just wasn't okay. The only thing that mattered was that I could exist in my skin, and the only thing that I could use was alcohol and those other powdered forms of alcohol. So pulled the geographic back to New York. I wound up homeless. I wound up living on the west side of Central Park, in the park, over by the 65th Street cut through, where I would dumpster dive behind Tavern on the Green when it was open, and I would rip off people as they would walk through the park in that particular neighborhood at night, that particular area. So for those who don't know, and I'm actually not embarrassed to say this, you know, this was a part of the park where the gay men would cruise each other, and they were easy targets, and I was a little animal. And that's what I would do, is I would just go and I would prey on these poor souls who were just lonely and scared and struggling the same way that I was. And that's where my alcoholism brought me. Those were the kinds of things that I would do, and I'm sharing in a general way. Not to wear it like a badge. I'm sharing it because it's come out on multiple fifth steps through the years. And if there's anybody who's going through the steps right now with a sponsor, I'm letting you know make use of that sponsor. Make use of the time, because it's the most freeing thing that'll ever happen. And I'll get into, you know, what happened. And that was just what it was like. So the beginning of August of 1985, I tried to rip off this one guy who was about 6'4", 260 pounds. And rather than put me face first into the ground, he sat and he spoke with me. And he said, "Why are you so violent and so scared that you have to harm other people?" It really was an act of providence. You know, for those who know New York City, there's an Orthodox synagogue over there, and there's also one of the oldest churches right over there, and they sit on both of the cross sections of the cut-throughs from the east side to the west side. So for me, it was really bizarre, and I don't remember if I've ever shared this from the podium, but he said, you know, what is so wrong that you're like this? And the truth was is that I had three outcomes: death, Rikers Island, or death. I didn't see that there was really about getting sober. And the guy offered me a place to stay that night. He fed me. I got to shower. I wasn't molested. And we called my father in the morning, and I gave him my last name and the phone number of my father's office, and he called, and he said, you know, "Hi, you don't know me, but your son is a horrible thief, and he tried to rip me off last night, and he failed, but he's going to die. Your son is an addict and an alcoholic, and he's homeless. And he's so scared that he's trying to harm people just to survive. He needs help. Are you going to help him?" Really, only through that act of providence, my father said, "Yes, send him over to Grand Central. Tell him to meet me at the clock in the center." Well, there was a booth with a clock in the center. We'll take care of him from there. So I went over to Grand Central the following morning. And my father put me up in a motel in North White Plains, right where the train station was on Metro North. I only had jail and death. And Rikers, for this kid, was not an option. Rikers for anybody is not an option. Period. I was terrified. Conveniently, I left out. I tried to take my life a couple of times growing up because I was so uncomfortable in my skin. It was a lot of pain. And I remember my father driving me out to the airport on the 5th. That was the first day that I was not drinking. I was crawling out of my skin. There was a Cat Stevens cassette with a song called Father and Son. My father dropped me off at LaGuardia, and he said, "Eric, you've caused this family too much harm. If you choose not to take advantage of this opportunity and pick up, please never call us again. And if you should get sober, in time maybe we'll talk to you. I wish you the best. If you die, we'll have you buried in a family plot. But please, never call us." And that was it. And I went in and I got on a plane to Minneapolis. Thank God my father had good insurance. I got picked up, I think it was Carousel 14, and driven out to a treatment center. Treatment was discovery for me. It was where I had really the first uninterrupted long shower and felt like I could finally get the film off of me. I felt like I had finally had a chance. I had been drinking and using for so many years, doing so many things with so many consequences, hating myself more and more every time. that those first showers were just spiritual, because I just felt like, okay, I got a roof over my head finally. I got food in my stomach finally. I don't have to drink. I just have to tell people I'm crawling out of my skin and that I'm not okay. And I could do that. Treatment was discovery. Well, I went through 13 and a half months worth of treatment. I went through primary, I went through extended care, I went through a halfway house, I went through a three-quarter house. So I am a firm believer that God gives us exactly what we're supposed to get. So if you're in a house, fantastic. If you're not, I have a lot of respect for you as well. Coming into these rooms is really, really difficult. And I remember they brought these A&A things into the treatment center I was at, and there was a speaker, and for some reason I actually heard him for the first time. He said, "Welcome. Glad you're here. So if you're new, welcome. We're really glad that you're here. This is a great place to be." That was the first time I had heard "glad you're here" in years. It was the first time I actually felt like, okay, maybe I got a chance. And it was the first time that I was actually willing to do something about my alcoholism. Now, granted, I don't have necessarily the same war stories or using experience that a lot of people have. I'm not here to compare my insides to anybody else's insides or outsides. But I can tell you, pain is pain. And it was there that I found that I could finally start to say, I hate me. I don't know why I drink. I don't know why I can't stop drinking. I don't know why I go through these things when I drink. I don't know why I pick the kind of people that I pick. I don't know why I have the kind of experiences that I have when I drink. And I don't like the way I feel because I want to die. I don't like that I can't turn my head off. And then at the same time, I was paralyzed with fear. If you knew how bad I was, if you knew the things that I had done, there was no way you would want to know me and that I wasn't welcome. And that if this didn't work, I had nowhere else to go. And that was absolutely terrifying for me, because that is the end. So I gave it a shot. The truth is that there was a kernel, this very tiny seed inside of me, not the mustard seed that we talk about, but the seed of, hey, I think I'm just going to buy a little time here. I got a roof over my head finally and food in my stomach and people to talk to, but I don't know if I'm really an alcoholic or not. Let me see. And little by slowly, I realized I was an alcoholic. So, I'm going to tell you a story. And this isn't my story, but it is my story. There's a little boy hanging out in his front yard, and he's all the way down at the bottom of the hill, and he sees this sign on the billboard. It says circus. And the billboard's up on the road outside of his house. And on that billboard and on that sign that says circus, he sees a man with a top hat and a big smile and a woman with a headdress standing on the back of a horse, and a man and a woman in these leopard kind of outfits, and they've got a lion and a tiger, and there are giraffes and elephants, and there are these funny guys on bicycles with these funny suits and these funny colored dyes and big red noses and big hair like me. And these funny hats, and it says the date, and it says $1, and it has an address, and the address is in town. And he doesn't know what a circus is, but he likes the way that that sign makes him feel. So he runs back up to the top of the hill, and he sees his his father, and he says, "Hey, you know, Dad, there's this thing called a circus that's coming to town at the end of the month. And if I'm a really good boy and I help Mom with, you know, the house and all, I do all my chores and I don't, you know, don't beat up on my sister, and I do all my homework, will you give me a dollar so I can go to the circus?" The father says, "Absolutely." So the month goes by and the kid does exactly what he says. He's really a good kid for that month. You know, doesn't harass his sister, helps his mom out, does all his chores, you know, does his schoolwork. And his father says, "You know what, you did exactly what you said you were going to do." And he reaches into his pocket and gives him a silver dollar, and the kid grabs it, and out the door he goes, and off to town he goes. So as he makes his way closer and closer to town, he can hear other people. And as he continues to travel towards town, that sound gets louder and louder, and there's laughter. And he can hear a lot of people there. And not only can he hear a lot of people there, he gets into town and he starts to recognize the people that he can hear. He sees some of the kids from school. He sees some of the kids that he plays Little League with. He sees the local police officer. He sees the postman. He sees the guys from the fire department. You know, he sees some of his teachers. And everybody is really just happy to see each other. And there's this camaraderie there. And he notices it, and he's like, "Wow, this is great." And off in the distance comes the man in the top hat. And as he gets closer and closer, the enthusiasm picks up. The voices get louder. And right behind the man in the top hat, as he comes towards the town, is the woman with the headdress standing on the back of a pony. And then there are the lion tamers. And then there are the, doesn't know what they are. They're elephants, and they're giraffes, and they're monkeys, and they're these guys doing cartwheels, and they all have these funny suits, and these funny ties, and these funny hats, and these big red noses, and they're doing cartwheels and chasing each other, and everybody's cheering as they come through town. And he says, "Wow, this is great. This is the circus." And finally they make their way through the main street of town. And finally that last man with the funny hair and big red nose and funny suit, big shoes, terrible tie, tips his hat. And he takes the dollar coin that his father gave him and flips it up into the hat. And runs back towards the house, absolutely excited, exhausted from all the excitement. And he gets to his house and he tells his mother and his father exactly what he just saw with the circus. And he runs upstairs and he falls asleep in bed, content. But the mother and father are just sitting there. They don't know exactly what to say to each other because they both realize that their little boy never made it inside the big tent, that he never made it to the circus. He just saw the pageantry that led up to the circus, that he really missed what the true experience was. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous did for me. It pulled me into the big tent. It pulled me in to find a group of people that had a solution. It pulled me into a group of people that told me they were happy, joyous, and free. It pulled me into a group of people where there were others, there were men who said, "I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since," and I would sit there and I would scratch my head and say, "No way. Yes way. No, I'm one of them now." And they talked about this big book. you know, and they talked about the different sections of the big book. But the truth is I was too afraid still to tell anybody the truth about who I was and what I experienced, because now that I was not in a treatment environment, and I remember I went through primary, extended care, halfway house, three-quarter house, now that I was out, if they knew the truth about me, I wouldn't be welcome. So I didn't tell the truth on my first couple of fifth steps. That's the truth. I was paralyzed with fear that I wouldn't be welcome. I did not want anybody to know who I was or what I had done as a using alcoholic. I didn't want to be accountable for the horrible feelings that I had about my behavior for so many years, tied to my alcoholism. So eventually the pain became so great that I probably came close to picking up that first drink, pill, or fix, or anything that could have affected me from the neck up. And I didn't. I was fortunate. I would walk back and forth. There was an AA clubhouse in St. Paul called the Uptown Club on the corner of Hamlin and Summit in St. Paul. And I would walk back and forth there having arguments with myself, talking to myself, because at least I was comfortable with those voices in my head. They were the only ones that allowed me to belong. And that's a scary realization. And that's a realization that came from not giving up, no matter what. These three guys covered in ink, piercings, wearing colors for a motorcycle club, walked up to me as I paced back and forth, back at the porch over at the Uptown Club, because there were people who would stand out on the porch and point at me, and they would say, "You see that kid there? That's a kid that's going to die. That's alcoholism. That's somebody who's not inside the meeting. That's somebody who doesn't have a sponsor. That's somebody who's not giving it their best chance to try and address their alcoholism." Well, I can tell you, we don't put odds on people. You know, we don't shoot our wounded. And I was definitely wounded. And they came up to me and they introduced themselves, and I couldn't look anybody in the eye back then, so I was staring at boots. I could tell you what footwear you had, because that's what I noticed. And these guys were all wearing these steel-toe boots, and they were intimidating. They were more than intimidating. They were the kinds of guys that you would meet up with at Rikers Island. They said, "What's your name, kid?" I said, "Eric." And they said, nice to meet you. And they introduced themselves to me. And they said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And they said, "You like coffee?" And I was like, "Yeah, I guess I like coffee." And they said, "We do too. Go get us three cups and meet us upstairs." And that was the hand of God. I still talk to one of those bikers. He's sober 43 years. He still wears his colors. And the other guys have moved on to the next, the great beyond. I fought, and this is my experience, I fought getting into the steps. My experience is that it's foolish. And my comment is, no matter what, don't. The steps saved my life. Finding a man who had a working knowledge of the 12 steps and a way to explain life to me and explain those steps and how they mattered in life so that I could have a life was vital to where I am today. You know, I struggled with the truth because I had been lying to myself for so long it was all that I really knew. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous telling you what I was. And I had to have most of you tell me what I wasn't. Have a good life. I had to learn that the struggles weren't calibrations, that it wasn't personal. It was just that there was something in store for me, and that I had to keep showing up and not give up. When people said, "Welcome, we're glad that you're here," I had to learn that they were in just as much pain as I was. And it was that empathy that became that bond for me. I finally found other people who said, "Yeah, I did that too." You know, and then they would tell me stuff that they did, and I would be like, "Wow, I wouldn't say that in public." You know, coming from a guy that's living in Central Park. You know, I got into the steps. And after admitting that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable, that I couldn't think a straight thought out of my head or out of a paper bag, and that I lacked soundness in judgment, and that I could only get soundness in judgment by turning my thoughts and my actions over to a power greater than myself that could solve all my problems. Now, that was almost like a task for Sisyphus, where I was pushing the boulder uphill. But eventually, I got there. And eventually, I was able to do that inventory in an honest way, where I could lay out the resentments, the fears, the harms. I could own up to what I did, you know, and who it affected. And then I could also take that moment and reach out to God, because I didn't understand what God was. I had been so caught up on the religious God of my youth that I didn't understand and didn't pay attention to that word spiritual. God of your own understanding. I didn't understand that it could be good orderly direction. I didn't understand that it could be a group of drunks. It didn't have to be Adonai, Jehovah, you know, whatever. It didn't have to be any of that stuff. Christ. You know, it didn't have to be anything other than a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. And then I took that risk. I finally shared all of the details that had kept me paralyzed. Ron and Doc and Triker laughed at some of the stuff that I thought was horrible. You know, half of the time they were sleeping, they were so bored. But I got through it, and little by slowly I became clear that I didn't want to become or be that guy that I had been my whole life. And that's what the fifth step did. It allowed me to get to that sixth step, and that sixth step was absolutely vital to understand that I had a chance. And that chance was to just simply be entirely ready, and then to go and to humbly ask the God of my own understanding, which wasn't very good. I didn't understand. I was just desperate and willing to just try. I'd hit my knees in the morning and say, "Please." And at the end of the day, I'd hit my knees and I'd say, "Thank you." I carried around a little notebook where every hour on the hour, I would say thank you, and I would write down how I was feeling, because I didn't understand what my feelings were. I would write down if I was struggling with my pride, my anger, my greed, you know, the lack of money that I had, the envy that I felt, or the fact that I felt I was owed something and I would procrastinate. You know, and I would talk about the fact that I was willful and dishonest. You know, and I would call, you know, Triker and say, "Oh, I feel terrible." And he'd say, "Well, put your hand up." And I'd put my hand up. And he'd say, "Shake it." And I'd shake it. And he'd say, "How do you feel now?" And I'd say, "Stupid. He said, well, that's a little different. And those were the jokes. Those were the things that I remember today. So, and I got into the book. You know, I'm not here to quote. Well, I'll quote one thing. On the bottom of page 34 in the 12 and 12, in the third step, it says, the effectiveness of the entire program will rest squarely on how well you've come to incorporate this step in your life. The step that they're talking about is that third step, making that decision to turn our thoughts and our actions, our will and our life, over to the care of God as we understand Him. Because that's what propels one through all the other steps. So I got into reaching out to other guys, trying to be of service, trying to simply say welcome, trying to expand the we, and always recognizing that this was a gift. This was really not getting what I deserved and getting what I didn't deserve. You know, getting what I didn't deserve was God's grace. Not getting what I did deserve was God's mercy. You know, so today, it's like, I don't know, I'm into my 41st year of continuous sobriety. Most of the people I got sober with are dead. They died of AIDS-related complex. They died of overdoses. They died of gunshot wounds. They died of stab wounds. They died of diabetes because they chose to procrastinate and not go to a doctor. They died of all kinds of horrible things, and then a lot of my friends died of old age sober. You know, a lot of people found out what their purpose was, and now that they're gone, a lot of us get to talk about how their purpose helped us. And that's ultimately what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we wind up finding family. We're born with relatives, but as my experience has shown us, as I've gone through the steps, as I've opened myself to other men, you know, I found people who are the most divinely empathetic, loving, supportive, non-judgmental, at the same time judgmental, crazier than a rat in a shithouse people like me, but willing to go to any lengths to put their hand out and to say welcome and to let others know that they belong. And, you know, at the end of the day, life has become just about living. It's this moment, you know. I owe everything that I have to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe everything I have to the men who have sponsored me. I owe everything to the mistakes that I made. And I owe everything to the fact that I never found it necessary to pick up that first drink, pill, or fix, no matter what. And that I fought for that plastic chair. That's the most expensive chair in the world. People don't realize it until it's not around. I know. So I'll close with this. I had to write it down because I am getting older. The benefit of my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that the people here have expended my ability to listen with my heart. That's what you guys and gals taught me how to do. You taught me how to listen here rather than here. And that's what the steps do. The steps teach us how to use this as the greatest tool to reach another person that's suffering. And the greatest thing that you can do is to work to save another person's soul, to help give them a chance at living. That's what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll close. The greatest mitzvah in Judaism is called Pikuach Nefesh. It's when you work to save the soul of another life. You get a clean, automatic pass no matter what you've done. So, I don't know why I shared that other than the fact that I just remember it, and it's not the same God that I reach out to these days, but it's definitely something that I utilize, that I believe in. The universe wants us to be connected. That's what this is. You don't have to be too afraid, you know. And if it can happen for me, it can happen for you. Thank you.
First I slip, and then I quit. To a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, wake in there I see. I look into love's window. For a soul that's been falling, takes me where the promise is. All in, sometimes quickly, sometimes slow. We get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants us, we walk eternally. Look into love's window, for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promise. Take me where the promise is.